know, sometimes food can seem like a high school popularity contest. There are the cool kids. These days, anything that's dark green, leafy, organic, free range. And there are the deeply uncool pariahs, the chemically processed, the sugar-saturated, the glutens. There's nutritional science behind all of this, but we're not always as rational about our food choices as we like to think. In his book, The Gluten Lie, Alan Levinovitz argues that food has become a modern religion, complete with commandments, prohibitions, and gospel truths. And the interesting thing is that he's not a nutritional scientist. He's a scholar of Chinese religion.
One of the things I think a lot of us are familiar with is the rhetoric of religion surrounding food. So you'll hear people say things like, well, this is sinfully delicious, or this is a guilty pleasure. And myself, as a scholar of Chinese religion, I also am familiar with religious diets. You know, Taoist monks had used these diets for many hundreds of years that made very similar promises to fad diets today. So these Taoist monks 2,000 years ago were saying, well, if you avoid grains and you eat our special proprietary supplements of milk thistle and mercury, you'll be immortal, you'll avoid disease, your skin will clear up, you'll be able to fly. And so I thought to myself, well, if there's all this religious rhetoric surrounding food, you hear people saying things like, why is my friend proselytizing their diet? Why do they seem so evangelical about the paleo diet? I said, well, maybe if I look at the history of food fads and fears through the lens of a religion scholar, I might be able to uncover some of the reasons that these fads keep occurring and why they're so powerful.
So let me break this down a bit. Are you making the case then that we approach food in part through a religious lens, that is, that religious patterns of thought, you know, dividing the world into good and evil, virtuous and sinning, that those habits of thought inform our food choices?
That's absolutely right. That's exactly what I'm saying. So it's not that all of our dietary rules are structured by religion and we can't trust anything about nutrition whatsoever. It's that we need to be very careful to recognize when certain kinds of biases or narratives or myths are shaping our understanding of food and what it is that we ought to eat and ought not to eat.
So we're very judgmental about food and equate some foods with virtue and some foods with vice, of course. But you suggested that it's not just that Coca-Cola, for instance, is full of bad chemicals and it's fattening and it's full of caffeine versus this nice apple is good for you. It's more complicated than that because the apple is natural.
That's absolutely right. So when I looked at the history of various food fads and fears, one of the myths that I encountered again and again was this idea of a benevolent nature that is looking out for us. So natural things are good, unnatural things are bad. And I see this manifesting itself again and again over and against the science, for instance, with things like GMOs. And I know there's going to be listeners right now that are just thinking to themselves, this guy is evil. He must be in the pocket of Monsanto. But what I want to tell them is, well, hold on one moment and think, maybe the speed with which people jump to reject evidence that goes against their understanding of food has to do in part with the fact that we tend to be more dogmatic about food, and we tend to construct narratives of good and evil and natural and unnatural. We're more dogmatic there than we are in almost any other scientific arena. Hmm. And that's something I think is really important for people to keep in mind, at least to try to open their minds to the idea that that might be at play in their own beliefs about what is good to eat and what isn't.
So, for example, you tell this fascinating history going way back, the history of sugar, and you said from the first time it showed up in Europe in, what, the 17th century? I think people were convinced from the beginning that there was something evil about it.
Absolutely. Well, so one, it was a foreign thing, and they thought it was unnatural. So you had it coming in originally from the Middle East, but it didn't appear as something you would have in food until the 1600s, and you really didn't get it in bulk quantities until the 1700s, where it was being used to sweeten coffee and tea. And so what happened was these scared Puritans attributed hypersexuality and scurvy to sugar.
Hypersexuality?
Yes, believe it or not. So that's the thing they were scared of, right? You know, kids and women shouldn't be too sexual. So well, sugar is pleasurable. It must make sense scientifically that sugar causes people, you know, women to sleep around and children to engage in what they call quite demurely the solitary vice. And as we move forward in time, you get to the temperance movement. People were calling sugar a gateway drug to alcoholism. And so to me, you know, this is not, it doesn't mean that 10 years from now, we won't have conclusive scientific evidence that sugar is indeed like cocaine and giving your child a slice of birthday cake is like giving him a shot of bourbon. That may be the case 10 years from now. Somehow I doubt it. But we ought to be cautious given our history of irrationality with sugar. We just ought to be cautious and with gun jumping on food in general.
As somebody who tries to eat healthfully, you know, I've watched food fads come and go, and it's maddening to try to keep up. You know, for a while, you're supposed to lower your cholesterol and not eat too much fat. Now it turns out, actually, you want to make sure you're getting enough fat. You know, same thing with sugar, carbs, whatever. What I don't understand is why can't nutritional scientists seem to make up their minds and keep them made up?
That frustrated me as well. And when I asked nutrition scientists about this, they complained to me that it wasn't them that was the changing their minds all the time. It was that people want to report on very tentative science as if it is fact. Science produces more evidence. And the problem with nutrition science is that the government and diet gurus are delighted to take very tentative science and turn it into dietary commandments.
What I don't understand is it sounds like food commandments have actually been part of religion, a lot of different religions, going way, way back. What's the historic link between food and religion?
People used to think, in the late 1800s, they used to think that these dietary commandments were some kind of proto-science. And so people thought, oh, kosher laws are about not eating pork because pork has trichinosis, or not eating shellfish because shellfish can make you diseased. But Mary Douglas, a prominent anthropologist, disproved that, and she showed that, in fact, kosher laws, for example, are about dividing animals that are easily categorized, so animals that fly, for example, or animals that are in the ocean, dividing those from animals that are not easily categorized. So when kosher law says, for example, don't eat fish that don't have scales, it's not because fish that don't have scales are bad for you. It's not some kind of proto-science. It's because fish that don't have scales are weird.
What you mean? So don't eat shark or dolphin because there's something kind of strange about
them. Absolutely right. And we don't want to eat strange things because we want to have good definitions. And we think you are what you eat, right? You don't want to eat a strange creature that isn't classifiable because we don't want to become weird.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that one thing both religion and food have in common is that there's a lot of fear at the basis of both of them. And both of them are habits of mind that help us deal with or make us feel more in control of fear.
I'm really glad you brought up fear, Anne, because one of the things I noticed from reading these diet books is they open by terrifying the reader. So they list every single chronic illness that you could be scared of, and then they pathologize you. So there'll be a little questionnaire that says something like, have you ever felt tired? Have you, you know, have you ever felt sad? You know, and so the recipe is to create a world of terrifying dietary demons to make a person feel like they need to be saved, and then to provide them with that exclusive salvific recipe.
Wow, it really is the structure of religion, isn't it? First, you're a sinner, then you find salvation and see the light, and then you must become proselytizer.
Exactly. And the thing that frustrates me so much as a scholar of religion is that religion itself is so wonderful and deep and complicated. And it answers so many important questions like how we ought, you know, or tries to answer them at least, reflects on how we ought to treat other people. What is it that happens after we die? Where did everything in the universe come from? And there's something, for me at least, about seeing religion, people's religion, reduced to a calculus about what will help them lose weight and live longer and avoid disease. That to me seems a little bit tragic. There's these great philosophers, Horkheimer and Adorno, and they bemoan the fact that people reduce food to calories and the walk to exercise. And I think that's just a wonderful line because to me, there's so much more to food than its nutritional content and the number of calories that are in it. And the fact that there are people out there who have to turn a walk into exercise in order to enjoy it, I think that's really sad, and it is a bad kind of faith.
Yeah, but to push back. I mean, I imagine there are plenty of people who would say to you, but regarding my daily walk as a form of exercise increases my pleasure, you know, or feeling that I'm eating really healthfully and choosing foods that are all organically raised and that don't have processed chemicals or sugars in them increases my pleasure in eating. So what's wrong with that?
I think you're right. You know, to a certain extent, individuals ought to do whatever they want. If it makes you feel better to eat a Chipotle now that they've eliminated GMOs, I guess in a sense that's fine. My concern, and I talk about this in the book, is that it's not individuals who suffer most from these kinds of beliefs. It's the fact that society at large becomes scientifically illiterate. So with GMOs at Chipotle, for example, most people don't actually go out of their way to think about the scientific evidence on GMOs. They demonize GMO foods. And consequently, they end up not thinking about things, for example, like the fact that Chipotle's soybean oil might be genetically modified, or that the corn syrup that Chipotle uses in all of its soda is still genetically modified, or that perhaps genetically modified organisms aren't the problem with our culinary culture. And perhaps the problem with our culinary culture is that people don't have time to cook, and people don't have resources to cook and don't know how to cook, or that companies are just marketing high-calorie foods to children, right? What ends up happening is individuals' dietary faiths get in the way of thinking in an evidence-based manner about what food is and how public policy ought to proceed.
Alan Levinovitz is the author of The Gluten Lie and Other Myths About What You Eat. We're going to take a quick break now, but coming up, the backstory to one of the largest national security breaches in American history. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International.